Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Delia Ephron, whose sister Nora Ephron passed away shortly after the recording of this interview. Delia Ephron's latest novel is The Lion Is In.
Also by Delia Ephron, Hanging Up, Big City Eyes, collection of nonfiction, funny sauce, humor books, and young adult slash children's books. Delia Ephron is also the author of a play, co-author of a play with her sister Nora Ephron called Love Loss and What I Wore, which ran for 2 years in New York off-Broadway, and has written or co-written several films, including Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, Hanging Up, You've Got Mail, Michael, Mixed Nuts, At the Other Extreme, Bewitched. But first, let's talk about your new novel, The Lion Is In. The Lion Is In tells the story of two young women running away. They pick up a third older woman, and they wind up at a bar, and inside the bar sits a lion named Marcel. So let me start by asking, what is the origin of the story? Is the origin a runaway bride, or is the origin a lion?
It was a dream. I was very anxious one night about some event that was going to drag on, and I thought, how am I ever going to survive this thing? And I went to sleep, and I had this unbelievably powerful dream. When I woke up, I almost didn't know where I was. And the dream was two young women. I knew their names, Lana and Tracy. I knew they were in their 20s. They were in this crazy roadhouse bar with a lion. There was a third woman whom I named when I woke up, Rita, and I knew she was older. And I knew all three women were on the run. And the lion, I pretty much had the title because I remember calling my sister up when I started writing this immediately in kind of a white heat. I knew it was a novel. And I called up Nora and I was telling her about it. And she said, oh, what's the title? Because in my family, it's a family of writers. And my father was always saying, that's a great title. Write it down. That's a great line. Write it down. So Nora said, oh, what's the title? And I knew. I said, The Lion Is In. And she laughed. So I knew I was home free. I knew the line would be in for everyone, that he would change their lives and that they would change his. So I didn't question it. It has many themes of my own life because it came in a dream. But very weirdly, it took place in North Carolina in my dream, and I had never been to North Carolina. I really did live in this story, and I lived in it during that anxiety period, and I was completely happy. So it was like I had given myself a gift. I gave myself a place to be when I was upset that was totally calming. And Marcel, my lion, functions in this story in many ways. He is first of all and foremost a lion, but he also is friend, at moments comforter, confessor, higher power, shrink. And I think I gave myself all these elements that became a story, a sort of real adventure story, but that it was a way to be, for me as a writer and just a person to be happy.
At that particular time, were you working on anything?
Well, I'm always working on things. I'm trying to think what I was working on then. Yeah, I was doing a screenplay at the time. I have a screenplay that's actually getting made about a pet psychic. Animals came into my life when I was a stepmother, all right? And I got a dog, and I realized that every stepmother should have a dog because someone in the house should love you. I believe in the power of animals to change your life. I really do. I had no idea I was going to dream about a lion, though. And two strange things about this, very strange things, were, first of all, I really didn't know anything about lions, but I imagined the lion relationship, and part of it's a love story with the older woman, Rita. That's part of this story. I wrote this all, and then I sent it to an expert at the San Diego Wild Animal Park, thinking she is going to nail me on this. I was such a wreck, I can't tell you. There's a moment in it that Rita, when she first relates to the lion, she goes off to the Pick and Save and gets herself a very delicious-smelling shampoo. It's a woman who's only used Prel, but she now discovers this wonderful shampoo, and she washes her hair, and she sits in front of the lion's cage. And the lion goes, just loves to sniff her hair, her wet hair. So I thought, well, wait till this lion expert reads this, you know. And she said, oh, my gosh, that is spot on, she said, because lions in captivity are scent-deprived. That's S-C-E-N-T, scent-deprived. And we spray air freshener around them to make them happier. You know, and she said the whole relationship of Rita and the lion, she ultimately does even walk him, she said, and
the dancing even.
Yeah, she said it was all completely within the realm of lions are social and they bond very powerfully to one person. Tigers do not. Panthers do not. Thank goodness I had not dreamed about one of those. And she helped me a lot. I mean, she told me lions love femur bones and that when they really like someone, they bump them or they lie very close to them and so that their bodies graze and all that stuff. I mean, she helped me a lot. But the basic relationship of Rita and Milan and Marcel, she said was true.
Delia Ephron, when you were writing it, the initial impetus came from the unconscious, but when you're writing it, how conscious was the writing of the novel in terms of forming the characters? Was it all kind of unconscious at that point?
No, it wasn't at all, because I believe in storytelling. I like to keep you turning pages, and I knew they were all running from something. I didn't know what they wanted, and I knew they didn't want their old lives. They were really at a crisis point, all three women. So that became quickly in my mind, I shaped that, you know, and that drove the narrative, what they were running from. But, you know, Stephen King says this great thing, which is that he puts characters in a very difficult situation and then makes them work their way out of it. And that's what happens once, for me, once I know my characters, the plot develops from the situation that they're in at the beginning. And these women are on the run, and I had to know what they were running from and who they were.
Is there any difference between writing a novel that way and a screenplay?
Well, one of the things about a novel is that you get to write whatever you want. I mean, you get to write it your way. It's your vision. And no one's saying to you, make the lion a duck. Or I really don't want a story about three women. I want it about three men, which is even more likely to be told in Hollywood. So I've always, as a writer, written books just because they're so personally mine. And I get to tell my stories, the stories I want to tell my way. And it also tells me where I am in my life or where I've been in my life. And one of the things this is about, I think, is that whether you have a lion named Marcel, who can be all these things that you need him to be at certain times, as well as lion, we all have the imagination to change our lives. And there are moments in our lives where we really need to find that bravery and that imagination. So I think that's thematically what's important, but also, you know, I'm a sister, and that's a big thing. I have three sisters, and these women form a sisterhood, and the sisterhood gets them through. I think that's a powerful theme in all my work.
The sisterhood theme obviously pops up in your play Love, Loss, and What I Wore, as well as your other work. You have three sisters. I know of Amy. I've interviewed Nora. Who's the other sister?
Hallie. She writes mysteries. We're all writers.
Had you thought about maybe adding a fourth?
No, because I wasn't thinking about it in that kind of way. I want to make it like my family. I just know that being a sister and also having fantastic girlfriends and how important they've been at times in my life, that's important to me, and I think that functions here. But there are three very important men in this book, so, you know.
What I noticed in the book, and what you don't get that much in most novels I've read, is a companionship among them where the three women, Tracy, Lana, and Rita, they protect each other in a way that forms almost a little circle, and no one else can get into that circle.
Yes, and first of all, in a place that they've never been, and they all have secrets and things they're running from, the bond is stronger than it would be, and because Tracy and Lana are both in a way motherless, and not even in a way, they're both motherless in different families, but motherless. And Rita is older and she needs their support in terms of bravery, and they need their mothering. There's a moment when Lana says to her, is my head too big? And it's such an important moment for me because I know she's waited her whole life to ask her mother this question, and she didn't have a mother who was there to ask.
The character of Rita at first was just one of those characters, but as time went on, I found myself being more and more drawn to that character. A lot of writers talk about one or two characters, in a sense, taking over. Do you think that happened with that character?
She's powerful. I know that because people of all ages identify with her. There's an emotional life to Rita, which is very dear. She's been in a soul-crushing marriage, and she's basically not frightened of her own shadow, but she has no real... I mean, just getting out of that house was the bravest thing she ever did. She almost left in a trance, and if Lana and Tracy hadn't picked her up, God knows, the husband would have, and she'd be right back there. You know, so I think that there's an innocence to her that is very powerful. Also, do you remember that woman in Tennessee who shot her minister husband? It's in Selmer, Tennessee, this woman did it. It was all over the papers for a long time. And I was very taken with that story in the way a writer can be obsessed with something, because I kept thinking, suppose you're the wife of a minister in a small town. You can't tell anyone because it's a small town and everybody else worships him. And you are so alone. That aloneness that Rita has, and then when she finally finds both Marcel and the women, I think it just played out in a nice way. But, you know, the other two are, child do you love more? You can't say that. I mean, poor Lana struggling with her, to say sober, and being still stuck with her awful personality she had when she was not sober, you know, and how does she let go of the anger and the need for trouble?
Did you have to do any research on either kleptomania or addiction?
I didn't have to do any research on addiction because both my parents were alcoholics. That's the truth. And I know what it's like to be sort of abandoned the way these girls are, because parents who are wrestling with alcoholism are not really being your parents in the way that they need to be. So I knew a lot about addiction. I grew up with it. Tracy, I did need to do, I am not a kleptomaniac, and I don't have anyone in my family who was, so I did a lot of research on that. But, you know, one of the really crazy things was even more powerful for me is that I'd never been to North Carolina, and I began to write all about this state, and after a draft, I thought, I better go down there, you know? So I go down, and I'm writing around, and I'm putting into the GPS just random destinations in this town, in this area called Northampton County. And in the book, Rita wants the lion to have a tree, and she finds this tree in the middle of a field that looks like it's been struck by lightning. It looks more like a sculpture than a tree because it has no leaves at all. I'm driving down this country road following the GPS, and there in the middle of the field is the tree.
And you'd already written that section.
I had already written it. I screamed. I absolutely screamed. And another thing that happened was I wanted to go into someone's house because I wanted to see what their houses look like. And so I answered an ad on the wall of a Mexican restaurant to buy bread that the woman was selling out of her house. I went into her house. I chatted with her. I bought some bread. And I want to say that in my book, Clayton, who owns the bar, who barely ever wants to get out of bed in the morning, has this one thing he loves, and it is his vintage 1957 Chevy Bel Air. Okay. So I'm talking to the woman. Her husband comes home. I chat with him. I leave, and he was driving a vintage Chevy Bel Air. It is now parked in front of their house, convertible, top-down, orange interior, just as I wrote it. I mean, how spooky is that? I was totally freaked.
There's a moment early on in the book where they drive up to the bar and the place, and I remember thinking it was very dreamlike. It didn't seem like a real place. Did you find any strange structure?
I did not find the roadhouse that I wrote. No, I didn't.
There was one image where in front of it is a parking lot, and that's where they put the tree at first. And the lion's in the tree, an empty parking lot in the middle of nowhere with a dying, dead tree, and in the tree is a lion.
It is a very visual story, and not just from dreams, I think, because I write movies that I do think of things. Lots of times I think of a scene cinematically.
I noticed in the book that while there is internal thought, I mean, there is a lot of subjectivity. On the other hand, compared to a lot of books I've read, this one could easily be turned into a screenplay, or more easily, because so much of the action is external.
Yeah, because it has a motor.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we call, you know, sort of, that's what I call technically in the movie business, okay. Something that's really driving the plot. You really want to know what's going to happen to these women. Their past is going to catch up with them. There's something, you know, I think that's why my editor, when I first met with him, he said to me, you know, this is Thelma and Louise plus one crossed with Born Free. And it just has an energy to it. I really strive for characters that you can really relate to and a story that keeps you turning pages. I like to read that, so I think I like to write that.
When you're working on a screenplay, Delia Ephron, you are thinking of, okay, act one structure, act two, act three, but not necessarily in a novel.
No. There's so much more freedom in a novel, and there's backstory in this. You really understand the world that each character came from and how they got to this place. And in screenplays, you're always refining and cutting and streamlining. I'm not someone who likes to read novels which are all internal dialogue. It's not like my favorite thing. But you've got to know everything when you write a novel, and the reader has to learn it. The characters have to really be flesh and blood.
You've written several screenplays in tandem with Nora and with others as well. When I looked on IMDb, is it the fact that everything goes through a million different people before coming out the other side for a screenplay, so that you're more willing to
ever? You have to be flexible.
Let me
just say that. But they're ruthless out there. I mean, they literally will just say, make the lion a duck. I mean, they really will tell you whatever they want. And the screenplay that I have that is expected to shoot in September, it's called Sammy. It's my dog movie. It's about a pet psychic. Well, it's been in development 10 years, and I've been fired twice. But I am back again. They just can't make it happen without me, so they keep bringing me back. I mean, you have no idea how many notes have been given on this, how many drafts have been ordered of me, as anyone. And the truth is, it's my original story. So had I been smart enough to write that as a book, I would be so much happier because it would just be out in the world the way I want it.
On the other hand, you've gotten a lot of money for something that didn't see the light of day either, I mean.
Well, it's an interesting thing because I always think if you're a screenwriter in Hollywood, you have a choice. You can either be unhappy or you can be a director, because screenwriters are basically hired guns. And as much money as you're paid, it breaks your heart whenever you're fired. And you really are fired. You are like potato chips. They just open another bag. It's really, really rough there. But it does pay well. And so, you know, there's this thing where you're thinking, well, at least I'm making money there. But then, you know, that's not satisfying. Well, I'm going to write a book because at least it's going to be my way. You know, so you bang back and forth. And I just feel so fortunate that I've been able to have both careers, because having movies made is tremendously exciting. I mean, you write a script and then it comes to life, and so many people go to work, and it has costumes and actors, and you don't have a lot of control, but, you know, which brings us to Bewitched. Which is where you've been heading.
I'm always fascinated by the way somehow these things happen. And, you know, when something goes wrong, you're always trying to speculate why and how. At what point, for instance, in Bewitched, did you come in?
I think there were many, many Bewitched scripts before Nora began, you know, was asked to direct it, and then we wrote a script. And then Adam McKay came on, who works with Will Ferrell.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. Every movie has a DNA if it's not a success. It's a different DNA for each one. And, I mean, the thing about You've Got Mail is, one, it's based on this absolutely irresistible story, Shop Around the Corner. Second of all, Nora and I had a tremendous passion for this material and a passion for books. And it was at the moment when there was this huge thing of the big bookstore putting the little bookstore out of business. And we had the perfect environment. We had the perfect, everything that we understood about it. And we were passionate about children's books. And in our movies, we always try to have something we're really passionate about. And we just love children's books. And the, you know, Meg has a children's bookstore. So I think that whenever something, the more strongly it comes out of your heart, which is why I like to write novels, because they all do, the more successful they tend to be as writers. Bewitched, I don't really understand exactly what happened there. Maybe I could give you a lot of reasons, but I'd sort of rather not, if you know what I mean, because there's so many people who have something to do with a movie. And even when you look at credits on the screen and you think, oh, that person wrote it, but you know, sometimes that person didn't. There could have been 10 writers, and the Writers Guild decides who gets credit by very strict rules. And sometimes you see the name, like I wrote on Sleepless. I did a lot of writing, but the Writers Guild didn't give me a credit on Sleepless. So Nora said, you know what, I'm giving you an associate producer credit. So you look, you think, oh, she associate produced, but I didn't associate produce, I wrote. So, I mean, all these credits, they're kind of a dreamscape, you know, unless it's like written and directed by, usually, you know, it is. And Bewitched came with a real history. You know, I wonder if there was a way to make that a modern piece. I don't know. I certainly don't know. I certainly didn't accomplish it.
For Sleepless in Seattle, since we're talking about a successful film, which part of it did you do?
Well, there were two writers before, at least two writers before Nora wrote on it. And then they offered it to her to direct. It was her second movie. She said, oh, my God, I'm going to direct this. You come on, please. Okay. So there were a lot of kids in it, and I'm really great at kids. So she wanted me there. And Tom had a lot of demands, Tom Hanks. One of the things, if you work with a star, a good star like Tom, he's smart and he's got ideas and he's really, really helpful about his character. So we had to rewrite for Tom and we had to make it funnier and better. And so I was very involved with that. But Nora had done a draft before me, which is why she got credit and I didn't. So what can I say? There are three people with credit on that movie. They have a rule, only three. I got shut out.
It always struck me that when you see a credit of three people writing the screenplay, four people writing the story, and three people writing the idea, that what you're getting sometimes works, but usually it's because something hasn't worked.
I think a great movie is a magical thing. I think the way the business is structured with all those executives trying to get you to do whatever they want, I think it is literally a miracle whenever a movie is wonderful. I think that process of collaboration is fraught with trouble. And when it works, it's magic. And when it doesn't, it's not.
And what about working on the play with Nora? Obviously, as sisters, you can read each other's minds at this point, which sort of makes it easier to write. I mean, did you send stuff back and forth? Did you sit down together?
We always do that send stuff back and forth thing. But this began with a book by Eileen Beckerman called Love, Loss, and What I Wore. And when we saw the book, we knew that it was a theater piece. Sort of the way I knew The Line Was In was a novel, and the way Sleepless was always a, and You've Got Mail were obviously movies. This was a play to us because it was a story of one woman's relationship to her clothes. She understood that if you told the story of your clothes, you would tell the story of your life. Very brilliant idea, really. So we thought this, her book would be one story, and then we would tell all the stories of other women and their clothes. And we knew from reading the book that you had this really powerful connection. If you read the book, you started to think about your own clothes. So we thought, oh, this should be live, so that we have women in the audience who are almost become a character in the play because they're remembering their clothes while they're hearing other women's stories. So we knew it was a play, and the vagina monologues had been done, so we thought it would just be women talking like that, you know, no vaginas, but that story. So we had this idea for it, and then we asked all our friends to tell us their stories. There are at least 16 women who have participated in this who are contributors, but we sort of shaped the whole piece. But I just want to say one thing, which I think is so important to anybody who's working on anything. This thing was dead for a long time. Nora and I workshopped it over and over again and couldn't make it work. One workshop so bad that we never even spoke about it afterwards. And then suddenly a director, Karen Carpenter, had seen it and had carried it around with her and wanted to do a reading. And we got the right casting and it suddenly worked. And I mean, 7 years. It was in a drawer for at least four of those. And so I'm just saying never give up.
Well, I've been doing a lot of theater interviews, local theaters, and I've gone to a lot of plays, and I've seen a lot of new plays. So many of them on so many levels are interesting but don't work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you come across an August Osage or, God help us, you know, Angels in America, you're just stunned that they do work. What I found is that Act 1s often work. Act twos is where the problem lies.
Oh, I think that's so interesting because I'm obsessed with act threes. In other words, I'm obsessed with a story delivering. It happens in books all the time. It happens in theater. Basically, it's a three-act structure, right?
Right.
I mean, that we're talking about, but there's only one intermission.
Right.
But I agree with you. I mean, it just happens a lot. Things don't really deliver. And I think it's the most important part of writing for me. I mean, this is shop talk, okay? But usually if something is not working at the end, it's because something isn't working in the beginning and you don't know it. You haven't set up the problem, the character, the story in a way that allows you to deliver the rest of your story. And so always, if there's a problem in what you could call the second act and I would call the third act, it's a problem in the first act.
When you were finished writing The Lion Is In, did you instinctively know that it worked, or did you have to, in your own mind, kind of start from the back and move forward to make sure that it worked?
No. Once I had it going in motion, well, that's my, I know I have a strength there. And you have to be willing to be sort of lost in the jungle when you write a book called Jungle, since I have a line. But anyway, you have to be willing to be lost and just trust that your subconscious has set this for me. I don't outline, but I know who my characters are and what the situation is. And then it starts to move and things tend to, they tend to develop. And grow and complicate. They have to complicate before they, you know, it's everyone's got a different writing style. You know, as I said, I'm not an outliner, but I believe in story.
At the end of the book, a lot of stuff comes together in that bar. A man walks into a bar.
Right.
Was that always in the back of your mind?
No. I knew the husband would show up, of course, because she left him. I knew that Tracy had stolen several things and that had to resolve, and how was it going to? I didn't know when Lana slipped the condom in her pocket at the beginning that it was going to be a huge plot thing at the end, but I just trusted when she slipped that condom in her pocket that somehow later on, yeah, the gun in the handbag, the condom in her, was going to play out. Absolutely.
Did you ever have to go back and add something?
Oh, yes, you always do. Actually, more backstories. You understood all my characters in a deeper way, and I darkened Lana a lot.
Was the diamond necklace that stole?
That was from the beginning.
From the beginning.
I never knew how that was going to play out, but I knew it was really important because, of course, Rita puts it on when she sees it in Tracy's purse. She knows it's not Tracy's. And she says, who I am is not a life sentence. And that, to me, was thematic for all these women.
One question I had, and I don't know if you were fudging or not, but what are the laws in North Carolina about having a lion?
I just figured, you know, Rita says in these country parts it doesn't matter. I think there are areas of the country where things are not as enforced as they might be in other areas of the country.
That's kind of what I figured.
You know, there was a really strange moment where I wrote in the book that when they arrive at the police station and there are no policemen there. And that was another weird thing that happened in North Carolina. I stopped in a police station and no one was there. And I thought, oh, my God, this is really crazy.
Politics do not play a role in this book other than the fact that we have here women who are kind of budding feminists in their own way.
I think they're finding their voices. Gosh, I'm a feminist, so, you know, I never disagree with that. And I think, like I said, sisterhood is important to me. And I grew up in a family where our mother totally believed her daughters would be working women and we would be writers, actually. That's the only possible option in my family. And I don't think she cared about much and anything else. And if we did anything else, she never noticed it. So there's no question that finding your voice as a person is something I grew up with. And I think it's so important because in the end, you never know what's going to happen in your life. But if you figured out who you are, you're at least have something that's powerful, but it's not to the exclusion of love. It actually includes love. It's just that I think they needed to find the imagination to change their lives and become the people they needed to be.
Nora said, because I asked her, in her collection, I Remember Nothing, there's a lot of material about family, and she's been mining her family for a long time. You mined your family in Hanging Up. And I said, well, what about revealing all of that? And she said, one thing that you and your sisters learned from your parents is that everything for a writer can be mined by other writers.
Yes. And my mother famously said as she was dying, take notes, everything's copy.
Really?
Yeah. So that's pretty powerful, isn't it? But here's what I really think. I don't think that anyone in a family has the same parents, because you're born into your parents' marriage at a different time, and your parents relate to each child differently. They're ones they identify with, they're ones they struggle with, they're ones they understand, and the ones that they don't. And I always think we have a really different story to tell about our parents. Having said that, we're all picking over the same bones in the Ephraim family. But I do think that we all had a different... I mean, just the simplest thing is, you know, my parents became alcoholics when I was 11. Okay, Nora was almost out of the house by then. Did it affect me more than her? Powerfully more. Right away.
And you were the one who wrote Hanging Up, which is about your dad. Curiously, of course, it turned out to be the last film of Walter Matthau.
Yes, it did.
Did you have anything to do with the film at that stage when he was part of it?
Yes, because I was a producer and a writer on that movie. You know, to me, the book is... It was a really important book for me to write because my father was dying and my father was obsessed with a telephone. He couldn't even recognize his own hands, and he remembered my telephone number. And the phone would ring at 4 in the morning, any time, really. And one day I said, you know, oh, my dad, you know, you're really, this is a lot, you know. And he said, I live half my life in the real world and half on the telephone. So that was the basis of my first novel. The thing about growing up when you're a funny kid, and I was a funny kid, we were all typed in the family. I mean, Nora was the smart one. I was the funny one. I have no idea what my younger sisters were exactly because they were younger. But they were amazing. And I always take very serious subjects and make them funny. That's part of what I did. I started with dealing with what was going on in my own home by being funny. And I think all my books, including The Lion Is In, they have very serious themes, but they're very funny books.
Speaking of being the funny one, do you see any difference between writing humor in a novel and putting it into a screenplay?
I don't know. It can get sort of jokier in screenplays, I think. I don't question my humor when I'm writing either nonfiction, which I sometimes write op-ed pieces for the New York Times or something, or if I'm writing a novel, the tone, the comedy tone. What I try to do is walk this line where I can go right into the drama, into the pain, and at the same time I can move into the comedy. And there's a zone that you have to be in to do that. If you're too farcical, if you ever let go of reality, you can't go into the emotional range. And if you go too deep, and, well, you can go as deep as you want, actually, on that side, but you have to be careful on the comedy side. But movies, you know, somebody else has an idea of how funny this movie is or whether it slots into comedy or drama, or it's a much more rigid business. You're trying to please other people.
That line between farce and seriousness, to me, that's one of the problems in a lot of those plays that I saw, is it's very hard to maintain the humor, to get as funny as you can and also maintain that truth, that emotional truth. That's the hard part, I would think.
I have a comfort zone in that, and I think it's from my childhood. I think because I always used it to cope, but there was always a lot of pain in the family. So I think I understand that in my gut.
Delia Ephron, all of this talk of feminism and sisterhood, how do you look at the entire Republican circus that we've seen in 2012?
I'm just upset about one thing, and I guess it goes back to my mother. My mother said a lot of stuff like veal should be pink and never marry a man with fat ankles and a whole bunch of stuff like that. But she also said that religion, organized religion, was the cause of all wars. And she said it 1,000 times a year. And I think there's just too much religion in politics. I'm upset by it. I'm really upset by it. I just go back to being my mother's daughter. I think she's right. I think religion is your own business.
I think that's... is a piece of the story, and I think the story runs a lot deeper. What we're looking at is a continued blowback of the 60s.
It's very confusing to me. I don't even understand the conversations that are going on. I mean, I don't understand why contraception is being debated or any number of these things. Right. I was extremely upset. I'll tell you, there's a moment in the Republican debate somewhere in the South, isn't either New Orleans or Atlanta or someplace. They were asked why their wives were, you know, good to be first ladies, and all three of them mentioned their wives' illnesses. And I thought, what? Is a sick woman? I mean, I have tremendous empathy for anyone who wrestles with any sort of illness. I almost think that women are being, you know, being praised for being sick now. And who's the best mother? This is a big debate now. I mean, we've got, you know, Michelle trying to be, you know, this perfect mother. And then, well, how can you argue with Ann Romney? I mean, she raised five boys. I mean, it's just, I don't even understand these mommy wars taking place, and none of it. I don't understand any of it, and it makes me sad.
Delia Ephron, they're starting the filming of the screenplay in the fall. What's the name of that movie going to be at this point?
Sammy, which is the name of the dog.
One final question about The Lion is in. When you were writing Marcel, I mean, you really had to go on instinct because being a dog person, I could tell that you want to make sure this isn't a dog.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, he's completely a lion. I mean, he has been vetted by the San Diego Wild, by Katie Buss at the San Diego Wild Animal Park. He's completely a lion, and everything he does is within what a lion would do. But yes, he is not a dog. He is a lion. You know, they roar. They know the power of silence. They are comforting to be around them. You feel their majesty. They are extraordinary looking, of course. Remarkable looking. We accept it, but think about it. And I think that they have enormous power.
Delia Ephron, other than the film coming out, you working on another novel yet?
Oh, my goodness. I haven't had any dreams this week. Right now I'm sort of thinking about Sammy, and I don't know what I'm going to do next.
How many screenplays do you have out there which are in turnaround or two?
Not in turnaround. Oh, no, no. I have two that may get made, but I don't have a big stock of things. Just like, don't depress me. I'm happy to say I do not. But I do so much writing. You know, this novel, I've been writing it for 2 years, and it's been my main thing.
A lot of writers like you, I mean, I could see why you probably would not want to be a director. Had you ever given any thought to doing something like being a showrunner?
First of all, you work 700 hours a week. If this appeals to you, you should definitely try for it. And the other thing is, it's someone else's show. I just want to say that I didn't really finish that thought, which is that you can either be, you know, unhappy as a writer, you can be a director, or you can take this third route and be a novelist. And then you get to have your own voice out there. I did not want to be a director. You have to make so many choices in 5 minutes as a director, and I can't even choose paint for my wall. So I knew directing was not for me, but I figured out I can be a novelist. So that was the way that I coped with Hollywood. You know, for me, it's all about the stories I want to tell.
Has anybody tried to option The Lion Is In yet?
Well, I have a director that I love who wants to do it. So we're looking now, we're trying to find the right producer and the right money. I'm trying to do it. Want to do it my way.
And that plan includes you writing the screenplay.
Of course.
You've been listening to an interview with Delia Ephron, whose latest novel is The Lion Is In. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover. Special thanks to Book Passage Bookstore in Corte Madera, California.